Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, January 7th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, 1 year anniversary of Palisades Fire and how homeowners can prepare for wildfires, and sea level rise, how one restaurant rises up to the challenge. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyone, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
On January 7, 2025, the Palisades Fire began in the Santa Monica Mountains in Los Angeles County. The highly destructive wildfire, spurred by the Santa Ana winds, went on to destroy 6,837 structures and take the lives of 12 people throughout the Pacific Palisades, Topanga, and Malibu before it was fully contained on January 31st. This fire was the 10th deadliest and third most destructive wildfire on record for California and was the most destructive wildfire in LA. At the same time, another wildfire burned, the Eaton Fire, which went on to destroy more than 9,000 structures and killed at least 19 people. Both fires collectively burned over 56,834 acres. As people affected by this fire continue the slow process of rebuilding homes, lives, and livelihoods, there are lessons to be learned from this fire and how to prepare for any wildfires that can come next. While thousands of people whose homes were destroyed in the fires have moved away from the Palisades and Altadena, some are still working towards rebuilding. Some of the hurdles they face include building codes that have changed since the fire, costs, and insurance policies that still haven't paid customers. KMUD News spoke to Robert Passmore, Department Vice President of the American Property Casualty Insurance Association, for the perspective of insurance companies during this fire.
Well, from an insurance perspective, since the first hours after the fires ignited, you know, insurers were out there on the ground helping families navigate the claims and rebuilding process. Over the past year, we've had over 42,000 claims filed, 94% of which have already had payments made. So far, the total payments are $22.4 billion. That's money that's been used by families to help restore or replace homes or their belongings and to help businesses get back on their feet again as well. The scope of these losses are such that that recovery takes time, but insurers are out there and working with their customers to get Southern Californians back on their feet to recover and rebuild.
The insured losses of the fires are anticipated to reach about $40 billion, making it one of the costliest wildfire events for the insurance sector to date. Since 2015, there's been a growing trend, or better put, growing fire season. Typically, fire season in California occurs between the months of April and October, but as California's climate has grown drier and hotter, fires cropping up in the winter months like December or January are far less unheard of. KMUD News spoke to Todd Lando, Battalion Chief and Wildfire Mitigation Specialist with the Central Marin Fire Authority and the Marin Wildfire Prevention Authority, for more information.
Fire services perspective, what we saw in January of 2025 was really a continuation of this new trend, something we've seen since 2015, increasingly destructive wildfires. Fact of the matter is these fires were not dramatically more aggressive or destructive than some of the other fires we've seen. But there was something unusual about them, and that was the month that they occurred. The month of January has historically been a very quiet month with almost no wildfires recorded in California. So to see two of the most destructive fires California's ever seen in a month where we expect to really see no fires is a dramatic reminder of the importance of climate change and the importance of preparedness. We have a year-round fire season now in California. We've been saying that for a decade, and Mother Nature proved it to be real last year.
The Santa Ana winds, occasionally called Devil or Diablo winds, are strong, very dry, katabatic winds that originate inland and blow from cool, dry, high-pressure air masses in the Great Basin. Much like the way the winds exacerbated the Arcata structure fire on January 2nd of this year, the Santa Ana winds were the leading cause of how swift both the Palisades and Eaton fires spread.
But to be honest, it was the Santa Ana winds. It's the winds that separate these fires from, less destructive fires. The communities themselves are vulnerable, and frankly, most communities in California are, and that's related to how close the buildings are, building materials, the design of the structures, and the upkeep of the landscape around the homes immediately. But wildfires are going to occur in California, and what's going to continue to separate the destructive fires from the the fires that your fire department can pull up to and put out within an hour or two or less is the winds. It's the Santa Ana winds in Southern California, the Diablo winds, we call them, in Northern California. And that's what really differentiates these large destructive fires from the other ones. And that's a weather trend that is concerning to us, because we have been seeing the Santa Ana type wind conditions more frequently in more months of the year, where they used to be confined to a very short period in the fall months in California, typically from August to November. We are now seeing them in every month of the year, including this week in parts of Southern California. That's concerning, and it tells us that this trend is going to continue, and it's frankly going to get worse.
The rebuilding process has been long and arduous for those who chose to stay in Los Angeles and rebuild. Much of the money that has been paid to those whose insurance policies weren't canceled during the time of the fire have gone towards temporary living expenses while their properties are inhabitable. Passmore elaborates on how homeowners and renters can be sure that they're covered in case of future fires.
Insurers have to get out there and assess what the damage is. And then once you've got that, then you take the steps for rebuilding. And those, that money that's been paid is for things like either, temporary living expenses, getting the initial parts of paying for the initial steps on rebuilding process. That's where all that money has been going. And that's our primary function here is to help people financially recover. I would say that one thing that we found that's really important is that people need to routinely review their coverage to make sure that they have the adequate coverage in place if something like this should happen to them. The cost of rebuilding a home has increased by 40% since COVID. Inflation has had its impact on material costs and labor, and that means it's going to be more expensive to rebuild your house. So it's really important that homeowners do a financial checkup with their agent or insurance company at least once a year to make sure that they have the adequate coverage in place. And they should make sure that the insurer has accurate information about the home. That means square footage and especially any renovations that you may have done to make sure you don't find yourself underinsured. And you also can talk to your agent about optional coverages such as inflation guard coverage or extended replacement costs or building upgrade coverage. There's been a lot of changes in the building codes. A lot of them have been aimed at making structures more resistant to fire. If your home is damaged and needs to be rebuilt, those are going to be some expenses you're going to incur. So you want to make sure that your insurance coverage accounts for that. And it's not just for people that own homes. Renters can also be affected by wildfires. There's ample stories about people who lived in a rental apartment or a rental home and lost everything. That's what renters' policies are for. They cover all of your belongings that are within that rental house. And that can go and also can provide right coverage for temporary living expenses that you'll have to incur while your home is being rebuilt or when you've been displaced after a fire. All those kind of things are things you can talk to with your insurance company or insurance agent to make sure that you have the proper coverage in place.
California's Zone Zero Law, AB 3074, attempts to proactively protect homes. The law directs homeowners to create a mandatory 5-foot ember-resistant zone around homes and structures in high fire risk areas by requiring the removal of combustible materials like mulch, dead plants, firewood, and more, by replacing them with non-combustible alternatives like gravel or concrete.
The proposed Zone Zero regulations, which are being considered by the California Board of Forestry right now and should be adopted in some form in 2026, really amending our current regulations regarding what we call defensible space, that space around your home that you need to maintain to be more fire resistant, and ensuring that it acknowledges the current state of science, what we understand because of the loss of 135,000 homes in the last 10 years. We need to focus on the first 5 feet primarily and with extra effort. The first 5 feet around the outside of your house is where embers accumulate when they blow towards your home during a wildfire. It's where those embers ignite things like bark, mulch, and plants, and especially any stored items that you might have in that 5-foot zone. Things like your recycling cans, your front doormat, patio furniture, anything that's within that first 5 feet that can ignite will ignite during a fire and put your home at risk. About 60 to 90% of the homes that burn during wildfires burn because of what was in that first 5 feet, not because of the big wall of flames that's moving towards your home, but because of those tiny embers igniting something within 5 feet of your walls. This regulation would require homeowners to remove things that are combustible within 5 feet and potentially regulate how we manage plants and vegetation within that 5 feet. That part is controversial, but it's important and it's supported by the science. We do need to reduce the amount of vegetation there and ensure that any vegetation that we do have is irrigated, well-maintained, and just moved a little bit farther away from the walls of your home.
Other ways that homeowners can preemptively protect their homes in case of fire emergency include hardening the building itself with fire-resistant materials like fiber cement siding and fire-resilient roofing materials. Lando elaborates further on how else people can protect their homes.
The defensible space regulations that have been on the books since the 1960s in California are still important, but we now understand better why that first 5 feet is important. You should always focus immediately after zone zero on hardening the building itself, though. And this is really something that we've learned much more about in the last 20 years or so in California. Hardening the structure with resistant building materials, things like fiber cement siding instead of wood siding. Resilient Class A roofing materials that can withstand embers, gutter covers that are designed to keep leaf litter from accumulating inside your metal rain gutters around your roof. Tempered glass dual pane windows can protect your home from igniting or windows from failing when your neighbor's home might be burning nearby. All of these things, especially combined with the protecting your vents that enter your attic or your soffit spaces under your eaves or your crawl spaces or your foundation vents, around the base of your house are very vulnerable to embers entering and igniting your house from the inside. So there are special vents and finer mesh metal screening materials that can be retrofitted to existing homes. They're required on new homes in California that will prevent flames, heat, and embers from entering those spaces and igniting your home from the inside. If you take these actions, your home stands a very good chance of surviving even the most destructive wildfires.
For insurance information for wildfire preparedness, the website is pci.org. For wildfire information resources for homeowners and residents, the website is readyforwildfire.org. Today, we have part two in a 7-part series looking at sea level rise in California from San Diego-Tijuana border all the way up to Humboldt Bay. We are visiting some of the people and places that are dealing with flooding, coastal erosion, and pollution, all made worse by rising tides. Today, we're looking at Humboldt Bay, particularly the King Salmon neighborhood. This segment was originally produced for KALW Public Media in San Francisco, which broadcasts on radio channel 91.7 FM in the Bay Area. KMUD's Sydney Fishman reported and produced this segment.
Today we have part two in a 7-part series looking at sea level rise in California. From the San Diego-Tijuana border all the way up to Humboldt Bay, we're visiting some of the people and places that are dealing with flooding, coastal erosion, and pollution, all made worse by rising tides. KLW's emergency and disaster preparedness reporter, Ren Farrell, is lead producer on this series. And Ren joins me now. Hi, Ren.
Hi, Hannah.
So a quick recap for listeners who might have missed part one. What was the last episode about?
We heard from KALW's climate reporter, Mary Catherine O'Connor, about a small community in Napa County that's struggling to agree about what they need to do to protect their homes from rising sea levels. There are about 130 houses on a 2-mile road with water surrounding them on both sides. And for almost a century, they've relied on a levee to keep the water back. But because of the way things have shaken out, every homeowner is actually responsible for maintaining the section of the levee that's in front of their house. And when one person doesn't do their part, everyone's house is at risk of flooding. Some people think there should be a community-wide levee repair fund, and some think the system works just fine as it is.
So individual action versus collective action.
Yeah, it's a very classic climate change story, in my opinion, and it's an issue that we can see playing out in communities across the U.S. and probably across the world. What one person does or doesn't do can have a profound impact on their neighbors, but some people just don't want to be told what to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Ren, where are you taking us today?
Today, reporter Sydney Fishman is taking us up to Humboldt Bay, specifically to King Salmon. It's an unincorporated community on the southern edge of Eureka. It's a small and mostly peaceful town, but 3 to 4 times a year, king tides roll in. And when those tides combine with heavy rain, it's not uncommon for buildings in King Salmon to flood with a foot or more of water. In collaboration with the Mendocino Voice, reporter Sydney Fishman looks at the impacts of climate change on one local business and the surprising way the restaurant's owner is dealing with sea level rise.
Yum.
Enjoy.
Oh, we will.
People in Eureka flock to the Falafel Love restaurant in King Salmon, partly for the view. The wood-paneled restaurant has tons of waterfront seating tucked right next to the docks. But they're also coming here for what might be Humboldt County's most beloved Mediterranean food. The owner, Avishai Liebson, is always in the back, frying up falafel wraps, fish, and lamb.
We're just trying to serve fresh and humble food. It's pretty simple ingredients.
But last December, Falafel Love faced a huge challenge. Three atmospheric rivers hit the North Coast, while the tides were at their highest.
So when I signed the lease, the landlord, which has now become a good pal of mine, had a little addendum saying that you were aware that this place floods. And I'm like, floods, sure, there's some water in the parking lot.
Our atmospheric river drawing closer to the coast, becoming a bomb cyclone, and the flooding concerns that we're starting to get higher confidence on where this cycle of storms will actually land. You can see the precipitation forecast.
Liebson keeps local tide charts on hand for these kinds of situations. After he looked over the charts, he realized just how much water was about to come into his restaurant during this mid-December storm. The morning when flooding was supposed to be at its worst, Liebson decided to head into the restaurant, grab his fisherman gear, and get to work cleaning up the water.
And then the water starts seeping into the building, and I was in my extra tufts because I fish, and they were almost on the top of my boots. I was like, oh, there's nothing really to do about this but to wait for the end of the tide and wait for the water to recede.
Liebson figured out how to capitalize on this daunting situation. He took out his phone and started recording.
And yeah, we just had about a foot or so of water in the building and made for a great viral moment that we were able to capture on video with a kayaker coming in. Yeah, we'll open around noon, you know, just another day at Falafel Love. You bet.
In fact, after the flooding, Liebson and his team received an outpouring of love from the Eureka community, which he wasn't expecting. They received hundreds of new followers on their Instagram and had help from locals in cleaning up the restaurant. And it's worth noting that this part of Eureka is somewhat remote. There aren't many restaurants nearby. So some customers, like regular Joe Brown, say they simply roll with the punches when the tides start rising.
It's us just chilling, you know, having tea, drinking, eating whatever we can, and hanging out, like just kind of like watching the water. But really what makes a difference is this, sitting outside on the water on the bench. So he's talked about moving to like better places and stuff like that. But really, is there a better place than you could be than on the water?
Liebson explains that overall, he had to spend thousands of dollars to fix the kitchen equipment that was ruined by the flooding.
We're definitely losing thousands. It's not in the tens of thousands. It's not gonna like break me.
On average, Liebson's restaurant floods about 8 days a year. He says that usually the water gets about a foot high and they only have to close up shop for a few hours.
Will it flood? Yeah. Is it sustainable? To a certain degree, yes. It's sustainable as long as you're resilient.
Liebson says that back in the 1980s, the Army Corps of Engineers created dunes in this area to help reduce flooding. He says that Falafel Love does not have flood insurance. He also says that he didn't get any financial or other support from the county when the flooding happened. But that didn't matter too much because the Humboldt community had his back.
We have a lot of marine biologists and fisheries biologists, and the Humboldt community is so involved in so many ways. And my grower friends immediately like, here's dehumidifiers and here's fans and like, dry your building down. Yeah, we got an outpour of support of what can we do to help and how can we be of aid.
But most people, like homeowners, don't have the same type of resources. King Salmon is a mostly residential neighborhood. And now, some homeowners are exploring ways to make their properties more resilient to flooding.
Some landowners have tried to modify their homes to make them more resilient to flooding, but that's very expensive. Typically, that involves like either raising a house up or remodeling it so that the occupancy is on the second floor or the third floor, but the first floor is parking or storage that's not affected by flooding.
That's Hank Seaman, the Deputy Director of Environmental Services for Humboldt County. In recent years, Humboldt County has received several grants to study how the area can adapt to flooding. It's also working with Cal Poly Humboldt to develop adaptation strategies for these coastal neighborhoods.
We're trying to understand specifically, you know, where's the flooding happening? What are the flow paths? You know, where's the water coming from? Where's it going? What are its characteristics? What are the consequences of that flooding? And then trying to come up with ideas, both more short-term and long-term, to try to help alleviate flooding, kind of more with the focus of the hazardous flooding.
Seaman says the county is also looking at ways to help both business owners and homeowners apply for permits to make their buildings more flood-resistant. But the forecast is still a bit scary.
In Humboldt Bay, we've got the plate tectonics that are pulling the surface down, which is essentially making the sea level rise go up faster.
That's Matthew Kidwell. He's the lead meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Eureka. Kidwell says sea level rise in Humboldt Bay is happening at an alarming rate. By 2050, sea levels in Humboldt Bay are projected to rise by more than a foot, the fastest rate on the West Coast. The message is clear. Local scientists and politicians say that coastal residents and business owners need to adapt in more tangible, concrete ways because sea level rise isn't slowing down. But in true falafel love fashion, Liebsen wants to celebrate the inevitability of sea level rise. He's even considering hosting a King Tide themed party at his restaurant.
We're still dreaming of having like the King and Queen Tide event over here. We're going to have people come in paddleboards and kayaks to the parking lot and have a little coffee serve. And when life gives you lemons, you want to preserve them like our food.
In Humboldt County, I'm Sydney Fishman for Cross Currents.
That was the second story in our new series looking at the impacts of sea level rise in California. You can find the whole series at klw.org/sea level rise.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last November, a stranded humpback whale near Yahats had to be euthanized after rescue efforts to put the 10-ton, 28-foot-long mammal back into the ocean failed. As Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports, what followed became a meaningful collaboration between the Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh Indians and a team from Oregon State University.
In mid-November, volunteers worked around the clock to keep the whale doused in seawater and to try pulling it back into the sea. Video from the Oregonian captured some of those harried efforts. Finally, on-site stranding experts and veterinarians agreed to put the whale down. A necropsy team from OSU prepared to remove samples to determine how the whale lived before getting tangled in crab pot line. Kurt Williams is the director of the Oregon Veterinary Diagnostic Lab.
I've never done a necropsy exam on a whale before. I don't think I'll have another opportunity. I hope I don't have another opportunity because I don't want this to happen to these animals.
Another group of roughly 20 Tsleil-Waututh tribal members also came. Among them was Lisa Norton, chief administrative officer for the tribe. She said they began by laying down tobacco and praying with Williams' team.
We offer up prayers for the animal and the bounty it's going to give us. People kind of did their own thing. They prayed in whatever way was comfortable for them, but we just spent some time taking in the enormity of the task.
There's been a historic tension between tribes and scholars, often due to academic institutions pillaging remains and artifacts from native burial mounds and village sites. But these two groups, standing side by side with the whale, worked in tandem, conferring with each other as they worked against the incoming tide and pending sunset. Again, Lisa Norton and Kurt Williams.
We were able to get them to get more specimens than they would have otherwise. And that resulted in them finishing quicker and getting more samples had they just done it on their own, but also allowed us to preserve more parts of the whale for future use.
Being able to work alongside the members of the Siletz tribe was amazing.
The Siletz have stored 1,500 pounds of blubber for possible soap or oil, while the whale's skeleton has been buried for possible use later as a museum piece. While the whale's death was a sad event for many, the collaboration between the tribe and university gave a primer for how to handle similar incidents in the future. Angela Sandana is the Natural Resources Director for the Siletz.
We would anticipate that if something similar happened, that we would revive those relationships and collaborations that we've built from this experience.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Indian Health Service, or IHS, recently announced 7 projects to build or renovate healthcare facilities, often in rural areas, throughout Indian country. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, one of those beneficiaries will be Arizona's Auction Indian community.
The tribe's chairman, Gabriel Lopez, is grateful.
Currently, we have a satellite facility, which is 2,000 square feet. It's a triple white trailer with minimal services.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. met with the Auction Indian community in November. After that visit, he made a social media post with Lopez.
The elders in the community have to drive 60 to 80 miles to get decent care, and they have to go through Maricopa County with all the traffic. So it's an inconvenience, and it can be a lethal inconvenience.
Auction will construct a 60,000 square foot facility and lease it at no cost to IHS for 2 decades. In exchange, the agency will lobby Congress on behalf of the tribe for federal funding to staff and maintain the building.
In a roundabout way, we're looking at maybe about 2 years to be up and running.
I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Sydney Fishman and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.